Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Adore.fm, and CairoRadio.com, and wherever else podcasts are available. Let's get started with the show. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 313 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I'm your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Yes, indeed, folks, we've got a great episode. One down, two to go before the end of Air Raid as we know it. Special guest this week, Sean Nelson. You may remember Sean Nelson from episode 30 of the Air Raid podcast. This has been one that I've always wanted to redo. I was completely unprepared. I was very nervous when Sean came in the first time into Dining Room Studios, where we used to record the Air Raid podcast. And I've always wanted to redo this, man. And Sean and I have become friends over the years, and I'm much less nervous around him than I was, and I think we did a reboot. It's basically a reboot of episode 30. We don't talk about the same things, and it's fantastic. Sean actually just left, and we had a very, very wonderful conversation, and it's a long one, and I'm not cutting anything out. Because I think you guys really have to hear it. It's almost 2 hours long, so buckle up, folks. With Mr. Sean Nelson, previously of the band Harvey Danger, and we're going to be featuring some music from Harvey Danger. Let's see, my favorite of their albums, and one of their most popular. Came out in 1997. It's called Where Have All the Merrymakers Gone? And we'll also feature, a song by Sean himself as a solo act. That came out a couple years ago, right in the middle of the show. Okay, all right. This is a long episode, man, and we touch on a lot of subjects, and it gets a little heavy in the second half. And I urge you guys to listen to that. Also, the first half, if you're not into me talking about politics or Sean talking about politics, we are decidedly on the more liberal side of the spectrum. So if you are a listener with more conservative ears or conservative leanings, you may not want to listen to it. But I urge you to. We might have some good points, you know. I don't know. It's a one-sided conversation is all I'm trying to say, all right? I'm not out there to skewer anybody. Not out there to talk badly about other people's political leanings, but you know, it gets it's like I said, decidedly left leaning. Okay, so just deal with it. All right, okay. We are just going to get right into things here because this is a long episode. Once again, though, before we do that, we are two episodes away from ending this here program. And I'd say it's starting to feel a little bit weird, man. It's finite. It's coming up. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. Oh, yeah. I do know what I'm going to do with myself because we have an announcement to make. I am teaming up with the guys over at the Stack of Dimes podcast, and we're going to start a movie podcast. It's kind of in the Stack of Dimes universe. If you're not a fan, you should be. It's one of my favorite podcasts, and it's going to be a complete honor to be part of the team over there. So go to stackofdimes.com. We will have our first episode next week at some point. It's either going to be Friday or maybe even the week following on Monday, maybe. I don't know. But it's called You Blew It, and we're going to be talking about just trashy, campy movies from the 80s. That have come out on Blu-ray, and they have really no they shouldn't be coming out on high fidelity, okay? Or high definition, I should say, high fidelity. That's music talk. That's music talk. All right, let's get into this chat. So be on the lookout. We'll post a link on our Facebook page at Air Raid Podcast on Facebook. Go search that out. Follow us there. And find out about the new podcast coming up. All right. This song is called, God dang it, man, Carlotta Valdez. One of my favorite songs off of the 1997 release, Where Have All the Merrymakers Gone? And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest Sean Nelson. We have a great conversation. Stick with us, folks. It's you're not going to be sorry you listened to the whole thing. I promise. All right. Be back in a moment. More of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us. Your machismo has always made me very
nervous. I hear that a lot.
No, it is. It's quality. Like the quiet, kind of reserved person.
Yeah.
Makes me nervous.
Yeah, because I can just strike like a viper anytime.
That's not, like no, that's snake. Not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, like, I am a very loud person.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I'm an extrovert.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so when I meet somebody or, you know, see somebody, I will try to give them a hug,
uh-huh.
You know, and say, hey, how are you? You know,
and they're like, fine.
Loudly. And they're like, yeah, fine. They're like, fine.
I'm fine.
It's good to see you, Aaron.
Thanks for the hug. I'm Mr. Hugs.
Are you Mr. Hugs?
Yeah.
Okay.
If
okay,
you've seen
good.
My chest tattoo, you'd know that.
Hug life is what it says.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but you've always made me very nervous. And I think I said this to you and Shenandoah when you guys were both on, a little while back, that you guys, I consider you guys very intelligent.
Uh-huh. Well, now you're making me nervous.
And intelligence is another thing that makes me very nervous.
Yeah. Well, it is to be feared.
To a certain extent, like I don't view myself as the smartest guy in the world.
Well, that makes two of us. Just kidding. Come on.
Ow.
You said you were nervous. No, I do. I think you are the smartest guy in the world. But I didn't want to just come out and say it right at the top if I kiss
right
your
at
ass.
The top.
Right.
But I'm really glad we're doing this because back in episode 30 of this show, mm-hmm. you came on.
Yes.
I was fully unprepared. And I don't think I had, you know, I didn't have a lot of experience under my belt talking mm-hmm. to professional musicians.
Right.
People who had been in the business for a really long time. And And, you know, it's a nerve-wracking thing to, like, because, you know, I mean, Harvey Danger was everywhere when I was growing up.
Right.
And I heard your guys, like, Flagpole Sitta was, you know, synonymous with the 90s teen movie.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, that made me a little bit nervous having you up in my condo in mm-hmm. the dining room studio, as we called it at the time.
Humble beginnings.
Humble beginnings. And I believe you were a little bit sick.
But not well.
But
come on. How could I resist?
I'm just setting these up for you to
the
knock
lowest
down.
Hanging of fruits.
See, you're so intelligent, you got that right away.
That's right. An award-winning reference, if ever there was one. I'll never do that again. I'm glad this show is ending. I'm not glad it's ending, but I'm glad it's near the end, because now I don't have to go and do it all the time.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, my God.
This is the last time I'll ever say those words.
On air raid.
Right, on air raid.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But I do appreciate you coming back, man. And I'm a little... This makes me a little bit emotional.
It's an emotional time. I mean, how long have you been doing this show?
6.5 years.
And how many episodes?
300. This will be 313.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, I mean...
An episode a week.
That's really impressive. Taking the hit to actually do it week after week.
Yeah.
That's how, I mean, everything that sticks around because it, you know, even when you're not inspired or even when you don't want to do it.
Sure.
You just keep doing it anyway.
Yeah, well, part of the reason that I am ending it is because I don't want to do it anymore.
But you have to just keep doing it anyway. Even though the show's going to be over, you still have to do
it. There's two episodes left after this one.
Right.
You know?
And you have some surprises in store?
We have some surprises, yeah. Yeah, some people, I'll tell you about it off the air. But,
all right.
Yeah, we've got some surprises. People that that I have been working on getting on the show for a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, right now, is something that I've wanted to redo.
Right. It's a do-over.
This is a do-over. I've never done this before
mm-hmm.
on Air Raid. And I think I'm more comfortable with you now because I feel like I know you.
Yeah. We're friends.
We're friends.
We're show friends.
You're show friends. We see each other. We see each other out in the wild.
Yeah.
Every once in a while. I will give you an awkward hug.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we go about our business.
That's right.
But I really appreciate you coming by.
It's my pleasure. It was an expensive Uber ride.
Was it?
I don't mean to plug the Uber Corporation because they have some, you know, labor issues. But, you know, I took the hit because that's how much I care about not just you, but, you know, really spreading the word about all the important work I'm up to.
You were at the Stranger Genius Awards last night. You are now what the arts editor,
arts and music editor,
arts and music editor at the Stranger.
Yeah,
which is a wonderful paper, a weekly free paper here in Seattle. How did that go?
It was a fantastic night. It was really it was the 14th annual Genius Awards, and it was. I've been to several of them over the years.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, people who don't know what it is from your, you know, international audience. But obviously everyone in America is familiar with the Stranger Genius Awards. But it's a thing where we give, you know, it's a play on the MacArthur Grant, which is called the Genius Grant. And we give $5,000 awards to art, you know, people, artists in, you know, visual art and theater and literature and music. Am I forgetting one? I know there are
arts,
five.
Arts, literature, theater?
Theater.
Is there a theater?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we gave awards to a lot of great people last night.
That's awesome, man.
Eric Blood.
Yes.
Fantastic producer and recording artist. And
Lindy West.
Lindy West.
Yep.
For her book, Shrill, and Lindy West, of course, started off at The Stranger, and she gave a really moving speech about, you know, the fact that she felt like she learned to write at The Stranger, and it's sort of...
That's pretty cool, man.
There was a lot of... everybody was really, really sincere and really, like... I mean, I was mentioning this before, but...
Yeah.
I think we all understand that the world is just about to end. And so I think everybody felt like, as long as I'm going to be on a microphone, I'm going to say something that I mean. And,
sure.
And it did feel like this sort of moment of unity in the Seattle arts community, which I frankly believe we could use.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
So, and it felt good to be part of it.
Like you said, we were talking about this in the kitchen before we started recording everything, but like, yeah, every time I turn on social media, there's some bad thing is happening, and you know, it does. It kind of, if you pay too much attention to social media and news media and magazines and papers and everything like that, it does kind of feel like the world is ending soon.
Yeah, it really does. And, yeah. And you know, I mean, maybe there are worse things than the world ending, but it's just the living in that kind of uncertainty.
I don't know if there's anything worse than that.
I don't know. I mean, the world continuing could possibly be worse for some of us, but it just seems like even if, say, Donald Trump doesn't get elected, the huge number of people who are for him or for what he represents, they're not going anywhere. It's not right. Like we're, you know, it's not like they will, turn into good orcs or, you know, or whatever. They're just going to still be there, and they're going to be further disgruntled. And, whether or not it turns into a civil war, I guess remains to be seen. But like the question right at this minute is there one more of them than there is of us?
Right.
Or is there the same number, or is there one fewer of them than there are of us? And that's like, that's the best case scenario is that there is one more, you know, non-hateful, racist, you know, disgruntled fucker out there. And so that we can, you know, like we, I say we, but we can win the White House again. But that doesn't necessarily guarantee anything other than that Donald Trump won't be in the White House.
Yeah. Or that there will be happiness.
Right.
Or that there will be, you know, peace within our own country.
Right.
Right. Like that's the scary thought is like, you know, no matter who wins, there's still going to be a whole bunch of disenfranchised people that think they're getting the short end of the stick.
Yeah. And they'll be, I mean, in a way they will be right.
Sure.
You know,
yeah,
they are. I mean,
for their ideals.
Right.
Right.
I mean, there are disenfranchised people who are legitimately disenfranchised
yes.
as well, who
yes.
are just as angry, but they just don't have, you know, they don't have a demagogue up and speaking for them.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, it's a really fractious time. And you try and imagine what could like who is the person who could like unify us and is there an us, or is there just a million different sort of atomized little us's out
yeah,
there? And
yeah.
I don't know. It's really like scary, and it's such a big thing that you can't see the edges of it.
Right.
I went to both of the Donald Trump rallies that
that's right. You documented this stuff for The Stranger.
Yeah, I was one of several people from the paper who went to those rallies, and it was like I just wanted to know, okay, is it like Nuremberg or is it like Hee Haw? You know, like
right,
is it a joke or is it real? And it's fucking it's so real.
Yeah.
And the you know I waited at the second one that was in Everett. I waited in a line with the,
what was the first one that you went to?
It was in Linden.
Oh, you went to that one too?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Which was like at a disused like rodeo or like a cattle auction facility.
Really?
Yeah. So like a really kind of
there's got to be some irony in that.
I mean, yeah, the thing is there are so many easy ironies to reach for that, yeah. you know, it's just like rednecks and dipshits and
herding people into a building.
Right.
Like
exactly.
Cattle.
Yeah. And it is true. They are rednecks and they are dipshits, but like they're still human beings and they still like they believe what they believe. And the big thing for me was that one, it was before he was officially the nominee.
Mm-hmm.
So he constructed his speech very much like bad stand-up comedy. Like he did 40 minutes just like insulting his opponents.
Right. Right.
You know, it was like a bad Don Rickles.
Yeah.
But to me, the thing that was the most chilling was that every time he said something that was very obviously like a laugh line, a punch line, And some of them were, you know, like it was kind of like almost admirable. Like he would be like, and let me say this about women. And by the way, nobody loves women more than I do.
Right.
Which is like, it's funny. Like
that's
it's intrinsically a funny thing
for
him
to say. That's
the part
that's not going to be,
right.
That's not supposed to be funny.
I kid the Mexicans. I love the Mexicans.
Oh, God.
But when he would say those things, I kind of chuckled in spite of myself because I didn't want to be, I didn't want to even feed the possibility of him. But I would chuckle. Meanwhile, the crowd around me of like a couple thousand people were just like roaring immense approval. So like that was when it was clear that even though he doesn't care about anyone or anything, they became convinced that he was speaking for them.
Right.
Because they're so desperate for someone to be speaking for them.
Yeah. Do you think though, and this is a thought that I've had for a long time, and it's nothing new. It's not novel, my thought. But I think that there is a large part of, like, the social media aspect of all of this now. The hate, the vitriol, the grandstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook, Twitter are, in my mind, part of the cause for all of this, I think.
It's possible. I don't know.
I think it whips people up into something that they don't necessarily really side with, but then they see all of the fake shit, mm-hmm. right? The fake reporting, the memes, you know, they're not getting the full story. Everybody's just reading the headline now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like that's what Facebook and Twitter are.
Right.
Right. And Instagram to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
I think that stuff has really kind of degraded our ability as a country to have a natural discourse or a civil discourse.
Well, I think that, I mean, I am always tempted by the idea that, you know, the media or whatever, like that somehow ideas are implanted in people's heads by, you know, mm-hmm. by the way we talk about things. And I don't actually believe it's true, but it is true that Facebook and Twitter have, they've corrupted the process so that like they've just sort of like funneled language and thought into their, you know, in Twitter's case, their sort of 140 word,
yeah.
you know, format,
140
characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh God. No wonder I've been,
oh my
it. I've
God.
Been doing it wrong.
You're getting
140
it.
words. Nobody ever retweets me. I mean, it's just that they have sort of made a smaller frame for everyone to sort of think about things.
Yeah.
But like to blame social media is to overlook the much richer possibility of blaming Ronald Reagan for gutting public education.
Well, sure. Okay. So let me clarify. Let me yes. You know? Totally. Let me clarify a little bit. Like I think more so it has whipped people up into a fervor
right.
rather than, you know, obviously those thoughts and those feelings are there,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's made it so much more of a big deal in people's lives.
Right.
They think certain things are happening all the time, so they're going to get really pissed off about it, right?
Yeah.
Because you're seeing it nonstop. You're not only seeing it on the 24-hour news cycle, you're seeing it on your Facebook feed.
Right. And it gives you an opportunity or even it feels like a mandate to, like, weigh in.
Yes,
But then also when, you know, like the other side of it that's damaging is that, like, when people are responding to some sort of legitimate outrage, I mean, like, cops killing unarmed black people mm-hmm. for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you can sort of, you know, type out your outrage and say something vitriolic about the police, no matter how cogent and well-meaning and even right you are, there is something about that that diffuses the impulse to actually do something more. And I don't even know what more could do.
Totally agree with you. Yes.
That said, before we had social media, there wasn't even a way to get the message out about it other than through the press.
That's true. Yeah.
And the press, you know, would talk about it, but not as much as it was happening. So now it seems like it's this new phenomenon that cops are killing black people for no reason.
Have you watched the O.J. Simpson documentary? From ESPN.
I obsessively watched both the documentary and
the show.
And the show.
I just finished the show.
Yeah.
Amazing. Like, the show was completely crazy and cheesy.
It covered like the camp element of it.
Yeah.
In a really fascinating way.
It's done so well.
It was a joy.
But the documentary, which the show slightly touches on.
Right.
Goes into kind of the era that OJ grew up in.
Yeah.
And they, in this one point, they share this story of a African-American man driving his wife to the hospital because she is pregnant and in labor. And they are driving too fast. They get pulled over, and he ends up being shot. There's no gun in the car. There's no drugs in the car. He's trying to get his wife to the hospital.
Yeah.
And that happened, I want to say, in like the 70s, maybe the 60s.
Mm-hmm. I believe it was early 70s.
Early 70s, yeah. After, you know, a majority of the civil rights movement was taking place. And that happens, man. Like, just unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And the media coverage on that was probably very thin.
Right. Or it was, you know, heroic cops, you know, step in to,
yes.
you know,
like, yeah.
That's the thing. It has been the message that has been communicated to me about through the increased coverage of this stuff is like it is one thing to bemoan the specific tragedies and to be outraged about it and to be furious about it and disgusted. Yeah. Like, no other response is appropriate or imaginable to me. You see it again and again, and you just feel like your hands just start turning into fists and just shaking.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's not like the thing that you always see is like, how can this keep happening?
Yeah.
And the answer is because it is designed to happen. This is not the system being broken. It is the system operating
as the system,
as like it is the system operating the way it was designed to operate.
Yeah.
You know? And so the question is, how do you dismantle and reassemble the system without, you know, you do wind up seeing people kind of arguing for no cops, you know, at all.
Yeah.
And that's, to me,
which, by the way, is not going to work.
Right.
That is not the route to take. Yeah.
But it is like new cops or no cops. And I would say new cops. Mm-hmm. But that means dismantling the police union. And it means like reimagining the concept of law enforcement as it has operated in America the whole time it has existed.
Yeah.
And that's going to take someone with courage and vision to even start that conversation, because that conversation has not entered the mainstream at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing that just came to mind is that there are a lot of people out there that I would say side with cops more than they do teachers.
Right.
Because there's a lot of vitriol against, like, the teachers' union, right? But nobody gets up in arms on that same side about the police union.
Right.
Right? It's like, get rid of the bad teachers. Yes, we can all agree on that,
right?
I think. You know, there are bad teachers out there. There are people out there that maybe have gotten up in their years and they just feel like they're not making a difference and they're just sitting back in their chair and letting the kids do whatever in the classroom.
Right.
Get rid of that person. I am all for that, right? I've got kids. I don't want them to have a teacher like that.
Right.
I also don't want to have a police officer that goes from 0 to 11 for a traffic stop.
Right.
Right? You don't want somebody pulling a gun on you for getting pulled over for having a rear light out.
Right.
If you feel, you know, at the very most, if you feel that you are in some sort of danger, pull your goddamn taser out.
Right.
Right? If somebody's pulling their gun, they should be out.
Yeah.
For something like that.
And yet there
it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I mean, it does make sense. Actually, both of those things make sense if you consider
who
is being recruited to do that work.
Well, sure. Yeah.
You know, like, who is drawn to doing the work of a police officer? It's almost certainly somebody who has a certain amount of violence and rage in them already. And
right.
It's, you know, because that is a job that answers that charge. It's the only one where you're allowed to shoot people with impunity without having to go to a foreign country, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's like, and with teachers, now you don't necessarily recruit people who have violence and rage in them, but you recruit people who are willing to...
Have you ever seen The Substitute?
Obviously. or Teachers, the Ralph Macchio, Judd Hirsch film of 1984.
Oh my God, I didn't even know that existed.
85, yeah.
Oh boy.
I'll admit I saw it because I had a crush on Jo Beth Williams in 1985. Excellent nude scene. But, I mean, people who are teachers are willing to go through, you know, a pretty long process of getting an education and getting sure. certified, mm-hmm. and then they go to work for a pittance, mm-hmm. considering how much of themselves they have to put into that job. And the classrooms are so overstuffed with people. You know, it's just like people who are willing to do that work.
Yeah.
Seem like they are also, it's somewhat self-selecting, you know,
yeah.
like there is a certain, the bar has been lowered so much in both of those cases, both of those professions. So that like, of course the people who are doing it are going to be doing it poorly. And there yeah. are exceptions, but where the fuck are the exceptions? Why aren't they, you know, making themselves more visible? Mm-hmm. And how do you join in the process of making them more visible? I don't know. I'm just here talking on your fucking podcast. Jesus.
We are solving some serious
yeah,
issues
I know.
Here, though.
Putting the world to rights,
yeah,
finally.
Yeah. Two white
couple
guys.
Couple of honkies.
A couple of white guys talking about the world's problems.
Yeah.
So on the subject of, like, the world ending.
Yeah.
You and I are both aficionados of, and I'm totally changing the subject here.
Best plan you've had all day. Your shit ain't worked all day, as Ice Cube memorably said in Trespass.
We're both aficionados of natural disaster movies.
Yes. Love them.
Have you seen San Andreas?
No, I haven't.
You haven't seen that one?
I haven't, no. I mean, there's
did it not interest you? Like,
I went to see so many of the recent iterations of the natural disaster movie, mm-hmm. and I know this is a tired complaint, but like the CGI versions of films that are about, like, I saw that movie 2012 with
yeah.
John Cusack, and like also the other one I keep thinking of is The Day After Tomorrow.
I actually really liked that one.
I was so excited about both of those because I uh-huh. do love movies where everything just falls apart.
Yeah.
But it really does just, like, at a certain point, it's like they cut from the, you know, the character's eyes widening and they see the, you know, tidal wave or the whatever,
right.
like coming towards them. And then it cuts to the wide shot of the destruction. And it is just like, they just cut to a video game. Like, it is just
right. yeah.
CGI. And I don't like movies as video games. I'm fine with that. I don't have any, I'm not an aesthetic classist in that way, but I don't like the way it looks. It doesn't have the impact. That's why the new Star Wars movie was refreshing, because it
yes.
was practical effects. And I mean, I guess it's too late for me to apologize for nerding out, but like that matters. Like, it matters that there is a physical thing that is, you know, in miniature or whatever, it tricks your eye
yeah,
rather
sure.
than just like,
yeah.
this is a simulation of the thing you're looking at.
Cause I didn't, I'll tell you right now, I hated San Andreas.
I'm not surprised.
I did not like it. I was in for 2012.
Uh-huh.
You know, I bought it on a whim because it was on sale at a movie store that was going out of business.
Yes.
And you know, liked it. Day After Tomorrow I really enjoyed
mm-hmm.
because I liked the ice.
The ice was good.
The ice was great. The San Andreas thing, you know, the earthquake stuff has been done a lot.
Yes.
And so, and I went in thinking like, oh, you know, special effects have gotten so good, they could really do a lot of justice to this. But it was just so incredibly, like, cheesier than the more cheesy natural disaster movies.
Right.
You know? love story, of course, you know, all that junk,
right,
that they throw in there.
I'm just
so,
also I
wasn't into it.
I have never fully been on board with Dwayne The Rock Johnson as an actor.
I think that's a part that played a part in my dislike for the movie.
Yeah. I mean, he is he cuts a bold figure on screen. I won't deny it, but I don't know. There's just something that he's lacking some essential human characteristic. I don't know what it is.
So, what's your favorite? Like, what would be at the top of the list for Sean Nelson for like natural disaster movie?
Oh man, thanks for asking, because now I can't remember any that I've ever seen. Yeah, I honestly my mind went utterly blank. I can't remember. Like, the first one that just jumped into mind is The Towering Inferno.
Okay.
But that's not my favorite, although O.J. Simpson is in it. So that's probably why it came to
mind. He is?
Yeah, he is.
No shit.
That was one of his first film roles, I believe. O.J. Simpson, Steve McQueen. I mean, does, you know, the Poseidon Adventure also really good?
That's
not
a really good
natural
one.
Natural disaster, but kind of. I mean,
did you see the remake on that?
No.
With Kurt Russell?
No. I couldn't. I love the original so much.
Greatest, most heart-wrenching drowning scene I've ever seen in a movie.
Really?
Most realistic drowning of a character. Seriously.
What was
they
the...
should, he should, Kurt Russell should win a genius award from The Stranger for that drowning scene. It is so intense.
He drowns?
He drowns.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert on a 1992
right.
movie. Yeah. He drowns in that scene, saving a whole bunch of people. He has to swim back down through the corridors,
sure.
right, to press a button.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows that he's not going to make it back, and then they show him drowning, and it is like, ugh. It's like watching a Faces of Death or something like that. It was very good.
Well, he's the only one who survives in the remake of The Thing, so I guess it's sort of it's a bold choice to let him die. I do love Kurt Russell.
Yeah, you can't go wrong. You can't go wrong with that guy. He's done a lot of great. I mean, you know, Overboard.
Overboard, fantastic.
It's amazing.
Captain Ron.
He built that whole thing for Goldie Hawn, you know, the closet on the yacht.
It was, that's the only way he could have tamed her. It was sort of a Taming of the Shrew story.
Amazing carpenter.
and
an amazing kidnapper. You know,
two of the important,
really well.
Of the most important qualities you can have. But you know, he played Elvis Presley, I would say pretty convincingly.
When
in the TV
what was that?
Movie from 79, 80, somewhere
okay.
like that.
Okay,
I think it was called This Is Elvis, or maybe it was just called Elvis. John Carpenter made it, and then he also did all those great action hero roles. And
yeah,
he's just he's good, good old Kurt Russell. I'm not having any luck thinking of another disaster movie.
I was giving you time.
Yeah.
That's what this was all about.
I blew it by talking. I changed the subject to Kurt Russell, as I often do. The Poseidon Adventure is great. The tagline on the poster is so great. The hell,
what was
up, the hell upside down.
Oh, that is good.
Yeah.
That is very good.
Are you
more of like a, you're more like a purist then? You go with the older disaster movies than you do the new.
I really do have an objection to the way CGI has been, like filmmakers have just ceded all ingenuity to the robots. There are good things. I still like it. I mean, I love like the Jurassic Park films. I even love the most recent one that everybody said was such garbage. I love it because it's dinosaurs.
I own it.
Plausible dinosaurs. I'll watch it. I'm there. That's part of what movies are for. Yes, they're for, you know, revealing the human blah, blah, blah. But I like it when they show you things you can't ever see.
Right.
Also.
Right.
And I don't think that that's a contradiction, I hope.
Yeah. I mean, when are you going to see a megalodon mixed with a crocodile in real life?
Only in my dreams, as Debbie Gibson
right.
reminds us.
Oh,
what's your favorite disaster movie?
You know, now... Did,
now you're blanking.
Now I'm blanking on it as well.
If only there was
I
an
really,
internet.
There's one that I really enjoyed. It was... Day After Tomorrow I really liked.
Yeah.
I was thinking of one, The Core.
Oh, yeah.
And
the core was great.
One of the reasons I like that one so much is because I am a geologist. So
me
like,
too.
So
no,
like,
I'm not.
We went, while I was in college, that movie came out, and we went the geology club, mm-hmm. which was just a group of people that really like to get drunk, mm-hmm. And the professors.
Right.
We went out in a big group and went and watched this thing and got tanked beforehand and just filled the theater with laughter.
Yes.
Especially at the diamond scene where there's giant diamonds floating around in the mantle.
But that's real. Just because it's not in your science books doesn't mean that it's not real.
We've never been down there, so we don't know.
That's right.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could be diamonds. Could be dollar bills.
Could be dollar bills. Just a bunch of Susan B. Anthony's.
That's right.
floating around.
Yeah, I remember.
Oh my
God. Is Hillary Swank in the core?
Hillary Swank is in the core.
The great Hillary Swank. Bellingham's own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing about disaster movies also is that they are basically like the disaster itself is just like the ketchup, you know, like,
sure.
And the movie sort of builds to it, then does it. And then there's, you know, how people respond to it. And so the movies that do that the best are the ones that kind of make the most of the kind of silly melodrama that, you know, like establishing the characters and all, you know, sort of all these sort of more high-minded elements of filmmaking.
Yeah.
When they, you know, kind of accept that this is like nobody's interested in this part, but we only have, let's say, at most 9 minutes of killer destruction.
Yeah.
To show you.
Right.
So you gotta lard it with, you know, 90 other minutes.
Yeah.
And so the movies that kind of embrace that and like really let the build up happen. I mean, I hated the film Titanic, but like that's the ultimate example of it. Like it's whatever. It's four
it's
hours.
Filler.
It's 4 hours of bullshit.
Yeah,
but then he really does let you have the good destruction. Like the ship.
Well, once again,
stuff
we go
great.
Back to practical effects, right? Like you can go back to like movies like Dante's Peak.
Peak. Let's go back to Dante's Peak.
Great job.
That's the good sequel. Let's go back to Dante's Peak. Was that the Linda Hamilton one? Pierce Brosnan.
Pierce Brosnan. That's Linda Hamilton. Yeah, she was the one that lived up. He was the volcanologist, and she was the woman that lived out in the woods.
Right.
Yeah.
And when they got together, it was murder.
It was absolute magic. Or like Volcano, you know, with
right. They
with
came out at the same
Tommy
time.
Lee. Yeah. Yeah. Tommy Lee Jones. Those were both great, and they didn't have a lot of like the CGI and stuff, and they really made you feel like something was actually happening.
My memory
like magma
of that
was coming up into Los Angeles.
Well, my memory of it was, and I'm from Los Angeles, so the prospect of seeing it destroyed by actual fire was very pleasing.
Yeah.
My memory of Dante's Peak, though, is that they made you wait for like an hour and a half.
Before the eruption.
Anything happened. So that was sort of... that.
But
that
it was like
a
other
bit much.
Things happening, man. It was like, you know, little lakes were boiling.
Sure.
And sulfur was coming into the lakes. All the trees were dying.
Mm-hmm.
And the fish were dying in the lakes and the ponds. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on in there.
That's a heavy message. But there was... Yeah. So, I mean, one of the phenomena that seems to recur is that one studio is going to make... You know, we're going to make our volcano movie because one of the special effects houses has developed a great trick for showing
they
lava.
Got a new they got a new smoke machine,
right? And so, but then another studio announces their version of it, and they compete and they come out. It's the free market at its best.
Isn't that the weird
it's
thing? Though they usually because they would always come in twos,
right? Dante's Peak and was it Volcano?
Volcano. It was
right.
Just called Volcano.
I don't remember. Yeah. Who or what was in Volcano? I do remember. I saw them both.
It was Tommy Lee Jones,
right?
Tommy Lee Jones was in Volcano. It took place in L.A. Like we were just saying,
mm-hmm.
And it was just like a fissure opened up in the La Brea tar pits,
where I used to go almost every weekend with my grandmother.
What is that like? What is that place like?
Hanging out with my grandmother.
Boring. How's
your
She's grandma?
Dead now, but it's sad, but it's fine. she was suffering. Well, La Brea. I think it means the tar. So
is that what that means?
The tar pits.
Oh, okay.
It was it was really exciting to me. And it, in a way, it's sort of the most purely American kind of like park you could imagine, because it literally is just a puddle of petroleum.
Yeah.
And then somebody had the genius to put a statue of a mammoth right in the middle of it. And so the idea, and then there are these little exhibits where you can kind of pull, you know, there's a handle that you can grasp, and you try and pull up on it, and it, the resistance of it gives you a sense of what it's like to be trapped in the tar.
Oh, yikes.
So sort of, and there are, you know, there are, I think, just artificial dinosaur bone skeletons, you know,
yeah,
sort of.
I don't think
they're, it's real archaeology. But it, I don't know. I always just thought it was, I thought it was, you know, magical.
Yeah.
I really liked it. But I hope that doesn't happen, because I just started to like LA.
Let's hope not.
But yeah, there was also Deep Impact and Armageddon.
They came out at the same time as well. Yeah.
Armageddon always. I mean, I hope you'll forgive my digression, but
I will not.
When Harvey Danger was on tour a lot in 1998, we had just played. We played for 2 weeks in Europe, you know, England and France, and you know, we thought we were pretty hot shit for having gotten to go to Europe for free.
Uh-huh.
And then, and we flew back from Paris, France, to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Yeah,
which is
from Paris to Myrtle Beach,
direct flight.
Oh my god!
And I don't know if you have ever been to Myrtle Beach.
I have not.
It is effectively.
It's like spring break year round, right?
Yes. It's like the world's largest miniature golf course of a town. The whole town is just a miniature golf course. And so we got off the plane, and we're bleary eyed, and it was 500 degrees, and we were just like, what, like, who are we? Where? Like, how is this? And we had a show at the House of Blues. The birthplace of the blues. 2 days later,
on the Delta,
yeah. I think we had 2 days off, and so we had jet lag and whatever. And one of our band members, I will not disclose who, it wasn't me, had smuggled some hash back from Amsterdam, and it was incredibly dangerous for him to do.
That would scare the living shit out of me.
Yeah, and it was completely uncharacteristic, but he did it. And
yeah.
So we were staying in some, like, you know, Days in motor lodge or something. None of us were tired, and so we just smoked some hash, went to see Armageddon.
Yeah.
And then went to dinner at an Outback Steakhouse, or maybe it was a Benihana.
You really came back to America.
Exactly, we asserted our Americanness in the best way we could, and it was, you know, that's, I always think of Armageddon in that. Oh my god!
Well, let's do this. Let's take our second musical break.
Okay.
And what should we play, man? Should we play some stuff from your solo album?
That's a good idea.
Harvey Danger.
I mean, it's really dealer's choice.
All right. Okay. Well, this is, and I don't have it pulled up right now. We'll put this in post. But this is Sean Nelson. We'll be right back with more of the Array Podcast for your ears when we return. Stay with us. You say you don't like when the words are too sweet, so you dip them in acid, then impassively ask why the skin's melting off of my face. Just one taste of your poison's a pretty stiff drink. Surrender disguised as defeat. I'll follow your lead, take a shoulder width stance for the dance of advance and retreat. Mm-hmm.
sent my whole fleet. A rookie mistake, it's the kind I make best, I confess. I was calling your bluff. Enough is enough, though you've sung the same song all along. It still sounds incomplete. When you catch yourself being too warm, you instantly institute sweeping reform. Put the word on the street, meet the new boss, advance and retreat.
You were checking your phone and you were getting all these pings that the Seattle Seahawks were playing today. We're using the song Flagpole Sitta,
yes,
as like some like coming on music or like
bumper music.
Bumper music, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you hate that song?
No, I don't hate it. I mean, I despise it. No, I don't. I don't. I don't. I don't hate it. I can't. It just feels like a it's very hard to maintain any kind of connection to it. Because it's like, well, first of all, it's 17, 18 years old.
Yeah.
Something like that. And, it has been played so many times in the world that it just like people, it just is outside of me, you know, and I'm not in a position to be performing it anymore. Cause I'm not really performing music right now, but, right, you know, a couple of years ago when I was when I had a solo band together, you know, we after years of me sort of really not wanting to play it, I played it a couple times and it was fun and good. And it, of course, you know, it's the one thing I have ever done that like lots of people are certain to have been exposed to in some way.
Yeah.
And in that way, I am both grateful for it and also resentful of it, because I've also done all these other things. And in the past, that resentment was maybe more dominant, you know, like because I was, you know, it's just the classic thing of like, that's not the only thing I've ever done.
Right.
You know, to most people, it is the only thing I've ever done and will ever do. And I'm sure it'll be on my, you know, tombstone. If I even warrant it, if I can afford a tombstone, but I mean, I'm fine with it. It's long enough ago now that it feels like this thing that someone else did, and it happens to have actually been me. But the fact that it lives on so much and in so many weird ways, I mean, there is no precedent in my life other than that.
Yeah,
for me being included in a Seattle Seahawks game.
Yeah,
for example, I'm not simply not quarterback material.
got the height.
I do.
I do have the height,
and I mean, I think I have a certain grit and determination that, you know, is hard to miss. many have remarked on it, but you know, the football is not my milieu for the most part. I'm fine with it, but like the idea that a stadium full of, you know, Seahawks fans would hear the song and feel roused by it in some way, or that the football team would kind of want to in some
but
way,
it's
would
kind
identify
of
identify with
it's
it.
It's kind of ironic that a song about kind of, you know, being bullied to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Isn't that, I mean, that's, from what I can remember, that's what that song is kind of about, right?
I mean,
being the outcast.
I mean, a little bit. It's definitely about feeling like standing apart from the million and being, you know, kind of obsessively aware of the paltriness of the way most people speak and think and act.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, football is also an excellent delivery device for that feeling. though I did briefly play football when
did
I was
you really?
Age. Yeah, I did.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was, you wouldn't know it to look at me, but I was athletic when I was a kid.
I can believe it.
I'm fine. I abstractly like sports, mm-hmm. but there was a time when I just made a really strong impulse like on a, I, it was a specific day, and it was in, I think, eighth grade, where I was just like, boom, I don't like sports anymore. And I was obsessed with sports until that moment. And at that moment, I stopped liking them and have never really liked them since. I did have a period of being really, really into the Sonics. I got super into the Sonics. And I even sang the national anthem at a Sonics game.
Really?
Yes. Which was thrilling.
What year was that?
99, I think.
Okay.
There is a VHS videotape of it. It doesn't exist online, I'm glad to say, because I really looked terrible that day. But because I, you know, that was sort of one of my anti-fame gestures. Look like shit. lucky. But you know, I liked it, and I like, you know, I like, I enjoy the, I enjoy the occasional Storm game. Mm-hmm. You know, I like the idea of sports, college sports, I guess, maybe a little bit more. But like the culture of it is so, I never feel like I make sense in that context. So having a song be part of it there's certainly irony, but it's a little bit satisfying to think that there's some particle of commentary that is being unrecognized by that world. I mean, we were on tour in Chicago in, I think, like 2000, and we got invited to a Cubs game at Wrigley Field. And I was like, of course, I'd never been to Wrigley Field, and I, you know, it's exciting to go. Uh-huh. And we went, and they played it during the seventh inning stretch, and they were like, ladies and gentlemen, we have some very special guests in the house. And like, it was, you know, the last, you know, one in a long line of last things I ever thought would happen to me.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, you hear it during the Super Bowl, you hear it during the World Series. If you watch those things, it's just there all the time.
Well, and like I said, it was pretty much in every teen movie.
It was in a few
back in the 90s.
Yeah.
That was made. I mean, I remember hearing it everywhere.
Yeah.
In that type of media.
It was in no danger of being underexposed. I'll say that.
That's right.
But you know, those things, like teen movies are always, they are, you know, aggregators of the song, like the songs of the moment.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
It's like, I'm sure whoever it was in the band The Flies or Lit or, you know, any of these other kind of bands that I don't even think of as bands. I just think of them as trash.
Yeah.
You know, have the same exact experience, and they're probably perfectly good people. But
was there any point though when that was happening that you were just like, ugh?
The whole time. That's really? All I felt the entire time.
Really?
Yeah, because the 90s really encouraged, like, my understanding of the culture was that ugh was the only appropriate response to everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, so in a way I didn't appreciate the kind of fun, good things that were happening.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a person who was very successful at having fun in general. It's not my steez, but I'm bad at it. But also, like, we thought that being successful in the way that we were successful, and mm-hmm. I really, like, it was all of us, but it was maybe especially me. We thought it was just gauche as fuck to be like, hey, everything's great. We're successful. We're making money. Our music is being played on the mainstream radio and on MTV.
Yeah.
And because it was so not just unfashionable or uncool, it was like, it felt like that only that only happens to the enemy, you know, in those days. And then, you know, like less than 2 years later, that was all over. They never played, you know, they never played sort of music by little bands or, you know, I flatter myself to say we were good or whatever, but like the world changed so dramatically. I remember being, there may have been some little lag, but like when they started playing the video for Flagpole Sitta in 1998 on MTV, mm-hmm. we were on tour. We rented a hotel room in, I think it was Boston, so that we could watch it air for the first time, because we knew what was going to happen. And it was, you know, it was fucking exciting. Of course it was. Though none of us particularly liked the video. It was just like, oh my God, we're in that world now.
Yeah.
That we never thought we would ever be in. But I think it
was
might...
Was that a good feeling, though? at that point?
It was. Yeah, it was. I mean, only because as long as we're here, you know, like, as long as we're doing this, you might as well do it right to some extent.
Yeah.
But I think it was maybe like sometime later, shortly thereafter, we were watching, you know, we were in a different hotel room and we were watching MTV because we knew the song was going to be played again, or the video was going to be played again, or something like, maybe it was an interview with us that was going to be played. I don't remember, but they were like, and now we would like to present a world premiere video by a brand new artist you've never heard of. But you know, we really love it. Ladies and gentlemen, Britney Spears. And it was Hit Me Baby One More Time video. And it was just so obvious that this was the future. And it was. Oh, no. It was the future.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we all sat there watching it with our jaws on the floor. It seems so innocuous now, the idea of this, like, completely, like, conflictingly alluring video of the young girl fully...
In a school uniform.
For, like, fully flaunting her sexiness in the context of also her girlness, not womanness, but, like, this was, like... the Lolita thing that has been written about a million times, but like it was just like, and the song is a masterpiece and the video is a masterpiece of a certain kind of thing. Yeah. And you can like the thing that it is a perfect example of, or you can not like the thing that it's a perfect example of, but that thing did become the most influential aesthetic and social movement of the next 10 years.
So did you guys get bumped from MTV? Did your video play, or did your interview play?
Yeah, it did. It wasn't like they played that instead of us. It was just like that happened and like, you know, and then we were still sort of in, we were in the
it's
mix
a weird
there
juxtaposition.
For a while. Yeah, I'll say. Like the least, the most, and now that we've shown you the sexiest thing ever, here are four sexless lads.
Look at this guy's hair.
Exactly. You've had your fill of sexuality.
Oh my God. So, I mean, was that, did you know, I mean, you're talking about it now, like you kind of knew at the time that this was like, oh.
Right.
Was that really at the forefront of your mind though?
It wasn't at the forefront, but okay. I found an old journal from around that time. I didn't keep great notes, which is much to my chagrin. But I did write down, saw the Britney Spears video, that is the future. Or so, like something to that effect.
Yeah.
And it was. I mean, you didn't have to be that prescient to understand that. But like, you know, we were still very much locked in the idea that like, that was sort of a malign influence, and that like that particular brand of pop. I mean, I never didn't like that song. I mean, maybe like is the wrong word, but like acknowledge that song is a perfect thing. It is a perfect creation. Now I can say it's great, but back then I wouldn't have been able to say it was great. I would have said it was like, you know, narcotic or so, you know, like some kind of tempered value judgment thing. But, you know, it is just a great piece of music and pop music, but that particular kind of pop where it was just like substance free, you know, really just like a TV commercial of a song, seemed to me to be
like,
the enemy.
Yeah. People want to call it sugar coated, like,
right.
You know, but I would even use the word, molasses.
Right.
Coated.
Right.
Because it is the stickiest substance known to man.
Right.
Like
right.
Pop to the power of 12.
Right. And I did not feel the same way about a lot of the other music that started happening around that time. Like I did, you know, you of course would hear Backstreet Boys or NSYNC or something like that. And I just, none of it gave me any pleasure. I didn't think it was good. I didn't think it was catchy. I didn't think it was well done even. It had its appeal to a lot of people, but the question of like, was it on the forefront of my mind? Because we were in sort of the MTV, you know, rotation, not just the song in rotation, but like we were considered a viable MTV commodity for a relatively short time, but like a couple of years. And the time I knew for sure that the time I saw the writing on the wall for sure was when in, I think it was late 98, it might have been early 99, I was in New York for whatever I was there. I can't remember. We weren't playing, but I was there. Mm-hmm. And REM had just or was just about to launch Up, their record Up, which was their first record without their drummer, Bill Berry. Okay. And it was like a real... It was a real transitional thing, and they were now a three-person band instead of a four-person band, and what did it all mean? And REM's my favorite band. And so I lucked out because, you know, REM is partially a Seattle band. And I knew Peter Buck, and I knew Scott McCoy, who had been playing in the band, and Ken Stringfellow from the Posies also was in the band at that time. And so I kind of...
Oh, I didn't know he was in REM.
Yeah,
or played
I mean,
with
he
them.
Toured with them.
Yeah.
And so I finagled an invitation to go see, they played at the Bowery Ballroom, which is a very small venue, and it was being filmed for or videotaped for MTV, and so I got to go see them in this tiny club.
Yeah,
and I was thrilled, and they weren't touring much at that moment. I think it was the first show they played at in that new lineup, and Joey Waronker was their drummer at that time. Anyway, I went and I saw it, and it was fantastic, and I, you know, hung out afterwards, and it was great, and I was very much like, yes, this is my life now. I get to hang out with REM backstage and be invited to the fun thing. And that was, I mean, believe me when I say I appreciated the fuck out of that. That was like the best.
You don't seem like a guy that would show that, though.
I tried not to.
Yeah.
I mean, I showed it to the... I was not like, oh, hey, what's up?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool, we gotta go. You know, I was like, hey, guys. I thought it was really good, actually. I don't know if you think it's good. You know, I'm like pretty dyed-in-the-wool, like, fan of music, and I'm not good at... I'm very... Like, the things about which I am enthusiastic, I am not ashamed to be enthusiastic about. I
sure,
don't...
Sure, sure.
There's a thing in music fandom where people... sort of act like they don't even know what you're talking about, or, you know, like they sort of, the backstage culture is very subdued because nobody wants to be the dork.
Yeah.
I will be the dork.
I was just the dork at the Suicide Squeeze, 20th anniversary party at Numo's.
Who did you dork out?
I dorked out to Childbirth.
Yeah.
I love them.
They're great.
I love Stacey Peck. Well, it was weird. I made it awkward. Like, I
you didn't literally dork out, did you?
No.
That would be bad form.
That would be very bad form. But, yeah. No, I fanboyed out a little bit, and, yeah.
Well, they're all pretty subdued. Like, they're not going to be like, very, oh, great, hey, thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
I have, you know, not fanned out that much, but, like, I've had some interactions with Chastity Belt because I wrote about their record being
so great. Awesome.
And I really love them, and I've interviewed them, and I know them, you know, like I vaguely know them vaguely socially, but our interactions have mostly been me as a journalist. Mm-hmm. And they are not like they're the way they have received the fandom that I have blasted them with was very much like, oh, cool. Thanks.
Yeah.
Like they don't try and build on it.
right.
But, you know, that's a perfectly legitimate response to, I think, being, you know, sprayed with admiration. But
let's get back to the REM thing.
Like, yeah. So I had this night with them, and it was great. And it was like, I cried. They played Fall on Me. I wept open, you know, and I'm a crier. It's fine.
Own it.
I do. Yeah. I have a lease with an option to, but you know, the economy in Seattle right now is so bad.
Yeah, it's hard, man. You're just renting. You're renting that emotion.
Yes. But, I also tangentially, met someone in on the floor of the Barry Ballroom that night who, you know, we started talking and it was a couple, and they said that they worked on the Charlie Rose show.
Hmm.
And I had just seen Michael Stipe on the Charlie Rose show not that long before that. And I was so, I mean, look, if Michael Stipe was speaking somewhere, I would know about it and I would watch it and I would love it. I was like, God, it was so good. Charlie Rose seemed really like a little confused by it or whatever. And they were like, oh, well, that's because he was high. And I was like, what? He was high? And they were like, yeah, anytime you've ever seen Charlie Rose on television, ever, he's been high.
Really?
He smokes more pot than anybody you know.
No way.
This is just what these people who claim to work on his show said to me. I'm not saying, I can't, you know, I don't want to get your show busted for libel as it's heading into its sunset path.
But, that's right.
Yeah. So anyway, all that is just a prelude. I was in New York, and the next morning after the REM show, I had to go to MTV to be interviewed on MTV Radio for something. I don't even know what. So I went to bed. Oh, also it was, okay, so it must have been late 98 because it was the World Series was going on, and the Yankees won that year. Just to bring it back to sports.
Yeah, you're bringing out your inner sports fan.
I'm not a fan, but the Yankees won. And if I were a fan, I wouldn't be a fan of the Yankees. But I'm not a fan of either, so it cancels that out. So I was staying in a hotel in Times Square, and the Yankees won, and the crowds were just massed in the middle of Times Square, just cheering and screaming all night long. And I fell asleep to the sound of New Yorkers like cheering.
Yeah.
Which was great. Annoying, but great. I woke up. It was an early interview, and I woke up and they were still cheering. They were still like screaming and chanting. And I was like, Jesus Christ, this is a baseball game. But I went downstairs and it was no longer the Yankees fans.
Yeah.
It was people massed outside of MTV because the Backstreet Boys were going to appear on Total Request Live.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to sort of, wade through this. I mean, more people, more kids for Backstreet Boys than there were humans for the Yankees.
Right, right.
So I'm like kind of pushing my way through. And it was really just like three blocks from my hotel to the studio. And I'm like kind of like squeezing my way through the crowd. And this is also right when Flagpole Soda was on MTV 20 times a week or something. It was a heavy rotation. It was doing very well. So like I had some like legitimate claim to being like recognized. and that it happened a lot in those days.
Yeah.
And just perverse, like it the way I could make sure it didn't happen is if I took my glasses off, but I will admit that I left my glasses on that day. And so I am like squeezing through this huge teeming crowd of like 9 year olds, mm-hmm. waiting for Backstreet Boys and holding up signs and like, you know, marry me blank or whatever the fuck their names were. And so I had a moment. This all goes back to me. This is like the moment I realized the writing was on the wall.
Yeah.
I'm squeezing through the crowd. I come face to face with this girl, little young girl, like no more than 13 for sure. And she's holding up a sign. She's like wide eyed and like really hormonal, like really waiting for the Backstreet Boys. And she sees me and we lock eyes and her eyes, which were already wide, like widened even further.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, and then she realized that I wasn't the droid she was looking for. Like I wasn't who she was. She just sort of clocked me from TV. And she went from like, oh my God, to like, oh,
right.
Forget it. And then just like turned and was like, and it was just, it was a weird moment where like the kind of fame and notoriety we had was not destined to be long-lived.
Yeah. Did you like ever really want that though?
Well, no. I mean, not in that sense, but it's a weird thing. It is a double consciousness because it's exactly the thing from Annie Hall where, sorry, I know Woody Allen is a complicated reference point nowadays. Yes. But I think we can just all agree that Annie Hall is still okay to talk about. But the thing where he is so anxious and like and condescending and like not into it when he has to go to Hollywood to accept an award TV or present an award on TV or something like that. And so much so that he makes himself sick, and the doctor comes to his hotel room and he's just in these like paroxysms of like, I don't know, like anxiety attack and just like food poisoning or whatever it was. And then, they say somebody, a phone, like somebody in the room is on the phone and they're like, they say it's okay. They're going to, you know, they're going to have somebody else do it. And he's like, what? Now I don't even get to go on the TV show? You know, it was exactly like that. It was exactly like, this is bullshit. Wait, it's over? You know, it was like that.
Yeah.
And then there were, you know, it did sort of trickle out. Like, it ended in a kind of anticlimactic way, I guess, mm-hmm. as it does. But there was a hard cut when we put out the second record and they were about to premiere the video for Sad Sweetheart of the Rodeo, which was the first single off of the second record. And it was a big, they were going to make a big premiere of it on 120 Minutes. And they announced it and they teased it all through the show. And then they were like, ladies and gentlemen, you remember them from a couple years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
But here's their new video. Ladies and gentlemen, Harvey Danger. And then they played Flagpole Sitter. Like somebody literally put the wrong tape in the wrong deck.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah. And then it was like, it was just sort of like a perfect, it was the perfect bad luck thing.
Oh no.
So that nothing.
Did they play the whole thing?
Nothing good ever happened again. Yeah. They didn't, I mean, they would hardly like
nobody
cut it
even,
off midway.
Nobody even, oh my God.
And gosh. So they wound up like, they were like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. We'll make it up to you. And the way they made it up to us was to play it like at 3 a.m. once, you know, a week later or something. So it was just like that gravy train had then left the station.
Oh my God.
And then we got to understand that all of the things that had gone right for us the first time around would now not go right the mm-hmm. second time around, which mm-hmm. did retroactively make us appreciate, or make me appreciate anyway, how good we had had it. But yeah. I didn't, like, at the time it was happening, it was our first experience, so we just thought, well, of course everything's easy. It's too easy. Yeah. The second time around, nothing was easy. We still had a decent time. It was fine, but, like, all of the doors that just flew open on our first record remained closed the second time. So
yeah.
That was kind of, it was hard, but it was, I mean, not as hard as most bands every waking minute.
Sure, sure, yeah. That's an amazing story.
Thanks.
It's a really good story.
It is a good story.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sad to live through. But
oh, my God, man.
I was fucking enraged.
I can't imagine doing that or having to go through that. That seems like, God, I don't know about you, but my ego would take a huge hit for something like that.
My ego was pummeled throughout that mm-hmm. whole experience, mostly because, I mean, we got so much attention, but, you know, I got all of the attention because I was the mm-hmm. singer, you know,
right. And people you're the thought, lead of the band, you people, were the face of it. Yeah.
People thought my name was Harvey Danger. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, the thing that I didn't fully understand or even partially understand at the time was that, you know, when you have a hit song, it means that a lot of people really like it. It also means that just as many people, if not more, hate it.
Yeah.
And then it means that still more people than both of those sides combined have never heard of it and have no idea who you are or what, you know, what you like. They don't like you are as nothing to them.
Right. Right.
And so your option, if you are like insecure or if you're like, if you need some sort of
validation,
yeah. reinforcement from how people think of what you do, which I at that time really did need, is that you have to take solace in the number of people who really like what you do.
Right.
Because the people who don't like it will be vocal. Though there was no social media then, thank the maker.
Thank Christ, right?
Yeah.
Or comment sections.
No comment sections. Oh, there were message boards just starting to happen.
You weren't seeking those out to see what people...
Oh, you were? Yeah. I would spend
long
nights smoking pot and desperately looking for any sense of, like, do people like it? Or do they hate it? Like,
what?
It's so bad. But fortunately, I learned that lesson then. And so I have not done it since.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Certainly not to the same degree. I did shut off... I stopped reading all press after the third Harvey Danger record came out, or by the time the third Harvey Danger record came out. But you are encouraged to take solace in the number of people who love what you're doing.
Sure.
And that was hard because the people who liked what we were doing tended to be like part of the. It's not a question of like mainstream versus indie in the sense of like cool versus not cool, but it was just like people who were like, we were exposed to such a mass audience that it was just like undifferentiated. Like sometimes people would be like, oh yeah, I really like this. It really like, it reminds me of, you know, Superchunk and the Turtles or whatever, you know, bands that I like. But for the most part, it was like, oh yeah, I really like this. It's just like Matchbox 20 or,
right.
you know, or like, the Scorpions, or no one said that, but like whatever the sort of mainstreamist, oh yeah, I love this. It's just, it really reminds me of the Eagles and fascism. I love that. And you couldn't, you know, you weren't, it's not for you to be like, you know what? I have to instruct you in what you really like and what's bad about what you like.
Yeah.
But that was my impulse then. And so I was just not built to enjoy it. I was built to see what was wrong and lacking in it.
Sure. So looking... Yeah, completely. I could foresee myself doing the same thing if I was ever successful in something that I did.
Well, my advice is don't do it. Don't make the mistakes I've made, son.
That's why
don't
we're quitting.
Successful.
That's why we're quitting. Before I get super successful, I want to quit.
That's the only way anymore.
Yeah. Just to, so I don't have to go through any sort of success.
But I mean, why are you quitting?
Well, there's a number of factors.
Right.
Number of factors. One, it takes a lot to put it together and to get people like yourself out here.
Yeah.
You were more easy because we are friends.
Yes.
And you wanted to do it anyway.
You.
Yeah. I mean, like lining up a show each week.
Yeah.
Is super, super difficult.
Right. And you've had, I'm sure, last minute cancellations.
Oh, my God. And I have, in the last 6 months, because of outside factors, have had to cancel on a lot of stuff.
Right.
And it doesn't feel good doing that. But you know, it happens. And it made me kind of reevaluate, you know, where I'm spending most of my time.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But you have, like, in the 300 plus episodes since I was last in your old studio.
Yeah.
You've definitely like stepped up with the name artists and like you've had some pretty legit, at least, you know, music folks and actors and like,
and it's been awesome.
Yeah. Like
it's been awesome.
Who are the ones that stick out in your mind as like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking to blank.
Well, in the early days, it was you.
Well,
I'm serious.
Yeah,
I'm serious.
Thank you.
And let's see. One that was more recent was probably John Carpenter.
Yeah.
Where I was on the phone. I called him up at his house.
Mm-hmm.
Still have saved his number.
Sure.
His
just in case.
Number, just in case I need it.
Texting him.
And I'm talking to this. right. And I'm talking to this guy and the whole time, and it wasn't very long. Mm-hmm. It was like 15 minutes. But the whole time I'm talking to him in the back of my mind is like, how the fuck did I get here?
Yeah.
What did I do to get this lined up?
You just put out a podcast every week.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been awesome. It has been absolutely awesome. Making friends with people like yourself, is a really cool thing, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So it's sad to kind of end it, but
what did you learn about interviewing musicians in particular? local musicians in particular, actually. I'm curious. Because I interview a lot of local musicians.
Sure.
But
yeah.
It's not for broadcast, generally. Sometimes on KEXP. But generally speaking, it's for print. And I have many observations about it. Because I've actually been doing it for like 23 years.
Sure, sure.
But I'm curious what your experience of it is. Are there any generalizations you have to make about what how local musicians, or how musicians in general, talk about themselves or don't?
Well, I think everybody's different in that respect, because we have had people on this show that really clam up,
right,
and don't divulge a lot of information. I mean, you know, the nature of the show, like we just did, it's very conversational. It's very sometimes deep, you know, and if people are willing to talk about things, then they'll do it. But if they're not, they're not going to open up,
right?
You know, to you or to anybody else. And that was kind of a really weird thing to try to navigate,
and learn how to navigate. Because you would find yourself stuck in this moment where you're
completely.
Like, tell me everything. And they're like, I don't know, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. To the point where like some of them wouldn't even make eye contact. Like,
sure.
Look down at the floor the whole time or something like that. So that was a huge learning curve for me. Because I've always been a good talker to people. To strangers in particular.
Right.
And that was a huge learning curve for me, because it was like, oh, come on, we're doing it for this other thing now. You can open up. And
right.
It's like, no, they don't have to.
Right. But it's the only reason you're there. That's
yeah,
the part, that's
right.
the part that always
right.
blows my mind. Like, I think I know a lot of musicians.
Well, I will say this, like a lot of people probably didn't know what they were getting into.
Right. But surely they knew when you said podcast and interview or appearance, like surely they knew that they would be asked some questions.
Sure.
And that, like, that's the part that always, especially now that there is such a, like, the culture of podcasting is such that everybody has now heard lots of people being interviewed,
right,
and talking about
right.
themselves. And even if they're not like devotees of podcasting in general, like when I started interviewing musicians, I started writing for the college paper at UW in 1993, and I encountered a lot of like what I the phrase we came up with to kind of characterize bands that especially from Seattle and Olympia who just wouldn't
give you
would
anything.
Not be I mean, I guess you could say that, but no. Like, we don't really think about that.
Right, right.
You know, and the question was like, how are you? You know, I don't really think about
that. Oh, my
like
God.
That. But there isn't, like, there is, not, like, there is a culture in Seattle of, like, good times and joking around and whatever, and or there's a culture of brooding, but there isn't a pervasive culture of, like, self-reflection and analysis of oneself or others. There is a bit of shit talking that goes on, but like the whole culture of like being voluble about the artistic process, all that stuff, it's just not part of the thing. And there is a good argument that that's why there's so much good work, because they're like
not focusing on that at
right.
all.
And maybe those things are, I don't know if you ever read David Foster Wallace's piece.
I've never read anything by David Foster Wallace.
Well, he wrote a piece about a memoir by the tennis player Tracy Austin that was, I said, fuck, this is a great essay. I don't like David Foster Wallace's fiction very much, but his nonfiction is the best, is my favorite. But he wrote this piece about it, and it was like, why does this book, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but like suck so many balls? Like, why is it so horrible? And why are books about specifically sports figures so fucking bad always?
Yeah.
Not just superficial or vacuous, but like poor, just bad, bad, bad. And he winds up kind of going through this whole thing about growing up and being obsessed with Tracy Austin and like really dedicating a lot of, she was like a 13-year-old phenomenon in the world of tennis. I can't believe how much sports we're talking about.
When I say we, I mean me. Yeah, it's coming back quite a bit.
I guess so.
I think I opened something up in you.
You did. I don't want you to cancel this podcast. But you know, he talks about being engaged by not only her playing and being like in awe of her as a player,
yeah,
which is legit, but also like being kind of fascinated by the reality of her as this 13-year-old, basically like discipline robot. You know, like
right.
All she did from the age of basically zero was hit tennis balls 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And how like basically what he's saying is that there's a lot to say about this. And she says, not only does she not say any of it, she says nothing at all.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit heartbreaking, but then he comes around to saying like that the kind of single-minded determination to be physically excellent and be like, to be a great athlete, it's not just that it doesn't like lend itself to being analytical about yourself. It's that the absence of analysis in that way, the absence of reflection, is actually the essence of what makes of the ability to be great, because you are single-minded. You're
sure.
Not like, oh, maybe if I, you know, I could do this.
You are literally thinking of nothing else.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in a way, you're not. It's not even exactly thought. It's just like pure being. It's not to say that you aren't. That it doesn't require making decisions. But it's really like your body is making decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not exactly true. It's local rock and roll, but
no. But you could categorize it as drive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But also like the part of you that plugs in a guitar and connects to a guitar and plays songs on the guitar and writes things and just like that isn't necessarily connected to the part of your brain where you're like, huh, well, you know, I thought a suspended chord at that point in the song would really, you know, speak to the vicissitudes of blah blah diarrhea, you know, like those things can be, they don't have to be mutually exclusive,
sure.
But it seems like
sure.
They tend to be mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
But that also seems to be like, it's interesting that then a lot of musicians that I have known can't even necessarily make the leap to like tell a funny story about the time they were, you know, at a bar.
Or what, oh, sure.
Like,
I just did a recent episode. And I don't know if you saw this, but it was literally the worst interview that I've ever had.
Yes.
In the time of the show. And it was with Junior Brown.
Right.
I have been a fan of Junior Brown since I picked up a guitar,
mm-hmm.
and my uncle introduced me to slide guitar. Him and, oh God, now I'm spacing on the name, Jeff Buchanan.
Right.
My favorite slide players of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get a chance to meet this guy, right? And I am flipping my lid at, you know, I'm going to get to talk to Junior Brown. I did a little bit of research, but I felt like I had, you know, I had enough knowledge on the guy that I could just go in there and do what we're doing now. And hopefully he'd be just open to talk about his life. I mean, the dude played with the Beach Boys.
Right.
Right. He's got to have some sort of story about this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And I go in there. He's an hour late.
Mm-hmm.
Shows up. He's very nice, very cordial. We walk upstairs. I show him where the green room is at the Neptune Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start in with the questions, and he just does not like where it's going. Basically shuts it down within 2 minutes and gets like agitated.
Right.
Like, you know, verbally agitated at me. And then tells me that, you know, I wasted his time. As he's wagging his finger at me and I'm recording this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes in and slams the door to the bathroom. And I'm just stuck in this room by myself, like picking things up, getting ready to go. And so I aired it.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? Fuck this guy.
Right.
You know, but he was obviously, you know, didn't have any idea what a podcast was. The guy's right. In his 70s.
Sure.
But he was obviously in it. In this interview to be asked the same round of questions that he's been asked and he has answered for the last 30 years.
And you went in thinking, Well, one thing's for sure. I don't want to just ask him the same questions he's been asking
exactly.
for 30 years.
Exactly.
I want to be the cleverest boy in the room.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Have you done that?
I have done it many, many, many times. Because to me, I have a little bit of a fetish for the person. Because I've gotten to interview a lot of people I've really, really admired.
Mm-hmm.
And
me too.
And to me, the like secret goal, in addition to getting whatever interesting conversation happening or whatever, is for them to be like, you know, I got to tell you, that was maybe the best interview I ever did. And
right?
I have
yes.
had, and I've had it from a few people.
Thank you.
And
yeah.
Or even just to have them be like, you know what, that was really good.
Yeah. Because
I know a lot of people don't like it. They look at being interviewed as a burden.
No. Yes. Yeah. It's part of the job that everybody fucking hates.
Yeah.
Really.
Except I think increasingly a lot of people love it because.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah. Because people want, like, if nothing else has changed in the world, your capacity for feeling anonymous has really sharply increased
as
everyone has been able to advertise themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the idea of being asked to participate in an interview, you feel like, well, at least I got that, like I have that going on. And then and also the way things are shared, it's not like it's just in a magazine that you can then like encourage people to buy.
Right.
Like you have the ability to put it out into the world. And that's that. I think that means a lot. But I do think that artists of a certain age and older are just like, oh fuck, Jesus fucking Christ!
Right.
Yes, Brian Wilson was a genius. Fine.
But that was a great Junior Brown impression.
Yeah. But what was what was the question? Was there a turning point question? Even though,
well, the turning point was when I realized I was on shaky ground, and mm-hmm. I said, "Okay, would you prefer?" And I wasn't planning on keeping this in the interview. This was just so I stayed on solid ground.
Right.
I didn't want to piss him off even more.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "What would you prefer to be called, Junior or by your true name?" And I said his true name, and that was the.
What's his true name?
His real
Aloysius.
Name. Oh, God. What was it?
Shmuel?
I can't remember. It's all there for
right.
you to hear.
I did listen to it at the time. But so that it was that? It was like, who the fuck do you think you're talking to? My name is Junior Brown.
Mm-hmm. That was the point it turned. Yeah. Do you remember?
That
so the
a
last
little touchy.
It was very
I don't
touchy.
Want to judge anybody.
Some people said that, you know what, maybe he's an alcoholic or he's an addict of some sort and he needed something right at that point.
And it was
to get you out of the room.
Or he just really had to pee.
He didn't want to
ask permission.
So he's like, got an enlarged prostate.
Fuck, this is... I've had enough. How dare you?
So the last time I saw you was... we were both interviewing Brett Morgan.
Oh, yeah.
The director
right.
of Montage of Heck for HBO's Kurt Cobain documentary.
Yeah.
And how do you feel that one went for you?
It went pretty good, I think. Yeah. It was.
I felt like I had a pretty good one with him, too.
Now, there's a guy who does not think of being interviewed as a burden. he was happy to talk.
See,
for
I got
England,
him. I got him say. Right after you.
Right.
I was talking to him right after you. Or,
we
no,
went
he
pretty
was,
deep.
He was. He did a telephone interview after you, and then I was after the telephone interview. But by the time I got to him, he was like. Because I was kind of asking peripheral questions.
Right.
You know, I didn't instantly feel very comfortable with him. And at one point, after the next peripheral question, he was like, he just goes, do you know how many times I've done this today? And it was at that point, I was like, oh, he's opening a door.
Right, exactly.
And I just veered off. And
what is this, a riddle?
It was fucking great. It
was
fucking great. But yeah, I mean, that was another one of those that that I was nervous about. You know.
Yeah, I mean, the opportunity to talk about what Kurt Cobain really means,
mm-hmm.
I could just do that
mm-hmm.
forever. That's
yeah.
like that is a subject that I never lose interest in, and I'm always aware of how. I mean, obviously, he means different things to different people, but part of being a true deep, like, Nirvana fan for life meant, to me, believing you understood Kurt Cobain in a way that no one else did.
Right.
And believing that, like, you know, it's just that...
Well, he became an idol, You know, right. He became, and when I say idol, I'm talking about like Jesus-like character.
Mm-hmm.
Because he, you know, yeah, he became that for people.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, he became it in a way that there was also baked into that reality, the understanding that it was both something he wanted and something he deplored.
Right.
And so that contradiction was super interesting and super rich. And like I moved to Seattle right at the peak of Nirvana, Rama, you know, like, and, so I missed the years when they were just like a local band. I came here in 92 and so already it was clear, and I was a huge fan. Like it's a huge part of why I moved to Seattle. It was hearing the record Nevermind, which is so like 25 years later, it feels absurd to even like, of course that's true, you know, but at the time is not something I would have admitted.
Yeah.
Because to me, I
understand. Well, that goes back to the whole, like, you know, the Seattle feel.
Well, that's the, know? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's the like the pinnacle of it is Nirvana.
Right.
Because to me, the thing of Nirvana was the only band at that time that I could think of where, because they got so huge so quickly, the only way you could really express your true love of the band, like your true, like, appreciation and love of the band was never to wear the t-shirt, you know?
Right.
And not like to not be one of everybody.
Exactly. I know.
And so
it's so dumb.
It's really weird.
It's so fucking
it was,
dumb.
I don't.
Cause I saw this from a third party view,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm younger than you are. I was 12 years old.
Right.
When that stuff was, you know, at its peak.
Yeah.
Or I guess it was later than that when it was at its peak. But, you know, and I saw it too. And we would do that as junior high students.
Right.
You know, no, I can't listen to that band. That band's corporate.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That was the fucking line.
The best.
It was like, who gives a shit?
Right.
Is it good? Do you like it?
The best example of that to me can be seen in the movie Hype. The Seattle documentary.
Yeah, exactly.
That kid, I would give.
Oh,
I would
my
give,
God.
So I really want someone to find that kid. That's a story I would love to assign for the stranger. Like, go find the kid who was in the Hype documentary.
Yeah.
With the earplugs in his nose. And he's got a flannel shirt on and he's at Grunge Fest.
And he looks like Seth Green.
Right.
He looks like the character, you know, which your song was in, 10 Things I Hate About You. He was dressed up like that kid, kind of.
Right. What our song was not in that movie. But, oh, you mean Can't Hardly Wait.
Can't Hardly
Wait.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, there you go.
But he says, he's like, yeah, I mean, I used to like all those bands, but, you know, now they're just like really sold out. And but like he's just saying words.
Yeah,
they
yeah,
don't mean yeah. anything. But it is exactly that kind of like confused consciousness. Like people knew they weren't supposed to like things that were corrupt, but being corrupt is the way that they were exposed to those things anyway. And like being able to differentiate between those things, it just made the whole decade into this morass.
I know.
And as it got more and more confused, it became much easier for like on one side, Britney Spears, and on the other side, Limp Bizkit to like, to just be like, we have no such qualms about being, you know, like we are not, you are having an argument about something that we don't even acknowledge the existence of. And then suddenly the rest of the world, this new batch of 10-year-olds was there and ready to be, you know, fucking destroyed by
That's
these
right.
people.
That's
and
right.
it happened.
Oh my God. Hey, we have got to, we've got to end this thing.
I disagree. I think we should really keep going.
Should we make a 24-hour podcast?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Let's
do it.
All right, let's keep going. Oh, shit, I don't have anything else to say.
No, me neither. And I gotta get my kids dinner.
Yeah, but, I have to go see the Monkeys.
Oh, that's right.
Speaking of idols, I'm interviewing Mickey Dolenz tonight.
That's gonna be cool, man.
It is truly the dream. Well, Mike Nesmith is slightly more of the dream, but like Mickey Dolenz, I will acknowledge that when I was about 13 or 14, I took a picture of Mickey Dolenz into the hair salon with me and was like, give me one
give
of those.
Me this.
Yeah, it didn't, she couldn't do it, but, I'm pretty devout about the Monkees. I just flew down to LA last week to see Mike Nesmith play his final show with the Monkees.
Oh, wow.
And I heard it was happening. So I went down there.
Oh, that's awesome.
God, it was so good.
That's great. Speaking of corporate.
Yeah.
Come on.
Well, they're the thing that like that makes the interesting distinction between like what is art, what is commerce, what
sure.
is trash,
sure.
what is glorious, yeah. and like the
and you know what,
the dialectic.
Trash can still be great, man.
Yeah,
trash can
is fantastic.
From Armageddon to Dante's Peak to the monkeys.
Yes, to yeah. David Foster Wallace.
So let's end this, Sean. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank
you. This has been a real pleasure. And I know we didn't really, this isn't really like a redo
mm-hmm.
of the of episode 30.
It's a do-over.
It's a do-over.
Yeah.
And I think it went pretty well.
I think it went really well. Congratulations on a really good long run.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
That that is a high honor coming from you. Seriously.
Well, I mean, I could hardly not say it. So now you can wonder if I meant
this
it.
This whole interview is going to be cut down to that one soundbite.
No, it is a really hard thing to not just, I mean, anyone can make a thing, and anyone can make a few things, but to really stick with it for a long time and dedicate yourself is an impressive achievement, and I salute you. If I had
well,
a hat, I'd take it off.
Oh, thank you so much.
I couldn't wear a hat with my hair looking this good.
You can't. That's true. That's true.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you.
All right. Well, there you have it, folks. Sean Nelson in all of his glory. Big thanks to Sean for coming on the show and spending so much time here in the backyard chatting with me, man. That was fantastic. I feel like I kind of redeemed myself a little bit with this episode since he was first on, and I'm feeling good about it. I'm feeling good about it. And man, that's probably one of the longest episodes that we have ever had, I think. I wanted to keep on talking to him. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I wanted to actually keep going on just every tangent that we could possibly go on. So I'm hoping I can meet up with Sean here sometime in the future. We can continue some of these conversations. That was fantastic. That was fantastic. God, can you imagine? Can you imagine being on the top of the world? With an album or a collection of songs that makes it big and stuff, and then all of it just kind of like you can see it happen right before your eyes, where it's like, oh shit, like we're not gonna have that anymore. Man, that would hurt. That would hurt me, man. Seriously, that would hurt me. Like I said, that's why we're quitting the Air Raid podcast right now, because we just don't want to get too successful. You can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes, and if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. Even though we're ending the podcast, even though we're ending things here in a couple episodes, we still want you guys to spread the word around. It still makes a huge difference. We want the stories from the people who've been on the show out there, right? It's fun to learn about new music. It's fun to learn about people's lives, right? That are making the music, making the art that you so enjoy. So keep on spreading the word. Go to iTunes. Give us a little review there. Only takes you a couple of seconds to give us a 5-star rating. And you can listen to us on all sorts of different things that are not going to go away, like Stitcher or Google Play or TuneIn Radio or at the Spreaker app. You can check us out there as well. Or subscribe directly to the RSS feed at air-raid.net. All right, people. This one is Flagpole Sitta. Why not go out with this song? We talked about it enough, right? We'll be back next week with an all-new episode of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Thank you so much for joining us this week. Everybody, have a good one. See you, see you next time. Yeah, that's what we'll do.